is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, the controversy over the new gun laws and gobble gobble, is turkey on the menu this Christmas?
Our freezer will be as good as empty, which is always nice for a turkey producer to empty his freezers out. Look, at the end of the day, I pride myself on all the customers we got, being able to supply them with everything that they wanted.
But first up today, let's turn our attention to the gun laws and the example of WA. It's been put up as an example for maybe New South Wales to think about. I spoke to reporter Joe Prendergast, who's been looking at the issue of the gun laws and the changes that they made in WA to reduce the number of guns that people have available, and also some changes to who is a fit and proper person. And I asked Joe what was happening, what was the impetus for those changes in WA?
Well, Michael, making our firearms laws the toughest in Australia was certainly the catch cry that we heard from the WA government when they were discussing and then passing these new firearm rules that we have. Every state has different rules for its gun owners, but WA is the only state, to my knowledge, that restricts the amount of firearms a person can own. That's been part of this new legislation that we have. And how many you can own and their power, or the category or the calibre of the weapon, really depends on the type of licence that a person now has. But generally, it's less than 10 firearms, and for hunters, the limit on their firearm ownership is about 5 or less than 5. But WA's new firearm legislation comes with a raft of other restrictive rules that make it pretty tough as well.
Yes, I know New South Wales now looking at the number of firearms people have. So what are the other changes that WA's introduced then for its owners? What are the other restrictions?
Well, there's quite a lot. WA has moved to a digital record keeping system. So previously it had relied on physical paper copies of licences and paper versions of things like property permission letters and storage statements. That's all now been digitised, but that hasn't been a smooth process because the website the government built for this process basically wasn't ready. Firearm ownership now requires health and mental health checks, which are to be done by a GP within set guidelines, but then WA police make the final decision on whether or not to grant that licence. That process is in an ongoing rollout, and that's because existing firearm owners didn't necessarily need a health check for their firearm to be compliant to the new system, but it is required for new applicants. It's all part of this determining if a person is fit and proper, which is the rationale that some medical conditions, disabilities, medications might actually impact a person's ability to operate a firearm safely. But there's ongoing debate around that too, Michael, because there's concern that people may now avoid seeing a doctor for things like mental health conditions because it might impact their firearm ownership. The new WA laws immediately removed firearms from anyone convicted of certain offences, such as family and domestic violence. But we have also heard criticism from some pastoral groups that the Act fails to distinguish between violent and non-violent convictions, and that can result in having a person who hasn't been convicted of a violent crime losing their licence. And there are pastoralists who say they can't now have a rifle on their property because of that rule. WA's gun laws also have new storage requirements, and there's some really complex rules about where a firearm can be stored, particularly around things like unoccupied buildings, like sheds. Some categories of firearms need CCTV. Basically, under these new complex storage requirements, the higher the calibre of the firearm and the more of them you have, the more intense the storage requirements are. All new firearm owners have to have these special thick-walled cabinets. Existing firearm owners were allowed to use their existing cabinets. So all of the firearms, they have to be compliant to these new storage requirements, and that has been a fairly complex process. But on the categories of firearms too, Michael, the WA government has banned 56 types of high-powered firearms and 19 types of ammunition which were designed to be shot over long ranges. So some fairly significant changes to who can have a firearm, where they can use it, and how it should be stored.
So what's this idea about a fit and proper person test? What does that mean?
Well, the legislation gives the police the power to determine if a firearm owner is, as we say, a fit and proper person. So the medical test that I mentioned is part of that. But then police can also look at things like a person's conduct and behaviour and their views, opinions and attitudes. So when you think about that, it's fairly broad ranging. The commissioner can also consider who a person lives with, who their family are, and who they are in business with, who they associate with. And WA Police Commissioner Cole Blanch has said in the media just recently that the ability to consider who a firearms owner is associated with is a really key power for police, because it basically allows police to vet people who might be on a terror watch list or things like part of an outlawed motorcycle gang.
Now, these new laws came into effect in March. What's been the reaction from the community?
There's been, I think it's fair to say, Michael, some pretty mixed reaction. On one end of the scale, some people in the community entirely support what government has done here. They feel like the less firearms in the community, the better. And at the opposite end of that scale is there are some people who feel that this is an outrageous erosion of their rights, and it punishes people who are law-abiding, and there are questions raised about whether or not WA's rules impact people who are determined to break the law, or how it stops the possession of illegal firearms. So there's still that those questions being asked around it. Within agricultural circles, there has been and there is ongoing concern about the consequences of some of the rules, and that concern largely sits around pest control and animal welfare. So farmers rely on recreational shooters to control some of their pests, and we've heard landowners' ongoing concern that less people are recreationally shooting, and so that will see more pests build up in the landscape. There's also been a cap on the amount of shooters that a landowner can authorise to come and shoot on their property. So there's been some concern raised within pastoralists about access to the calibre of firearms needed to control larger herbivores, and that conversation about pests, the consequence of that, it's really one that time will tell whether or not that is realistic, because the numbers will build up or not. But we already have a very healthy feral pig, donkey, camel, rabbit problem in WA, so those numbers will definitely be something to watch.
Joe, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
Joe Prendergast, ABC Rural Reporter in WA. Well, David LaFontaine is a farmer and competitive shooter from Balfour's Peak near Inverell in the New England region. He spoke to Christy Reading about the idea of a cap on gun numbers, but he says that needs more consideration.
A couple of points, Christy. I'm a farmer. I'm also a competitive rifle shooter. In regards to the caps, I think that there needs to be a recognition that firearms, even in a competitive situation, are just pieces of sporting equipment. And they each have a role. Generally, if you go to a major sporting competition, you'll take a backup firearm. And so, as Kevin Anderson rightly pointed out this morning, that we're flapping about not knowing what the government is going to do with them planning to change legislation by the end of next, or claiming to plan to change the legislation by the end of next week, of this coming week. I mean, my thoughts are that there needs to be a considered approach. The current legislation makes numerous provisions for checks in the issuing process, for if a license is issued and proven to be in error, then that can be revoked, it can be suspended. Firearms can be removed from a licensed firearm owner instantly in the case of an AVO or a firearms prohibition order. There are enormous options available for the authorities if the firearms license holder is proven to be, there's a reason for that to be taken away. So I just think that they need to slow down, get some expert input, not only from the anti-gun lobby, but also from the other side of the debate, and make changes that are meaningful and not just a knee-jerk reaction.
Do you have concerns? I mean, we spoke earlier about, does there need to be extra considerations or certain considerations for people in the regions and gun owners in the city?
There's one point I'd like to make on that, and that is that we talk a lot about the bush-city divide. Recreational hunting, where if you leave what people's individual views on the ethics of it are, it provides a link between urban areas and rural areas. As a farmer, there are people's understanding of what goes on in the bush is getting, in urban areas, is getting more and more limited. There are very few links, and recreational hunting does provide a link to between the urban and regional areas, which I think is important. The more people can understand what goes on in rural areas, then the better they can understand where our views are coming from.
Talking about the situation with the gun laws there, that was Balfour's Peak farmer and competitive shooter David LaFontaine speaking to Christy Reading.
The Country Hour.
Celebrating 80 years.
Understanding how they grow best.
The Country Hour.
Nourishing the people in their own community.
Part of your community for 80 years.
It's highly regarded.
Weekdays at noon.
Go straight to the source.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Phil Donato is an independent member for Orange in the New South Wales Parliament, and he says he's concerned about the speed at which changes are being made, and he thinks that law-abiding gun owners may well be penalised about issues that are really just the failures in the system and nothing to do about gun owners per se.
Yeah, look, I think obviously what happened last Sunday night at Bondi was horrific and should never have happened. The fact that now, you know, we're almost a week down the track and we're being urgently recalled to Parliament is, in my view, to address firearms-related legislation. In my view, I'm concerned about the haste in which it's being dealt with. We still don't know the full facts of the matter. We still don't know what's come out of the investigation. We still don't know, you know, what the legislation's going to look like. But I'm worried about the haste in which this legislation is going to be brought on and expected to be debated. Nothing ever comes good when legislation's ran through at short notice.
The bill's currently still being drafted, as we understand, but the Premier has alluded to some things, including limiting the number of guns an individual license holder can own. He was quoted saying that, or pointing to WA, which had a limit of 5 weapons, but he said, I think that's too many. What's your view on that specific aspect?
Yeah, well, look, it's not the firearm that kills people. It's the person behind it operating it, and it doesn't do anything to address that. I mean, restricting the amount of firearms that a licensed holder can legally own will do nothing to address public safety or to mitigate these things from happening. What we really need to look at is the real cause of this issue, and that is there was a clear error by both ASIO and the New South Wales Firearms Registry in their failure to recognise the correlation between the father and son and the issue of the licence, even though he wasn't an Australian citizen, even though the son was on an ASIO watch list. I mean, these agencies, these government agencies, have the resources, extensive resources, both in terms of systems and programs and other intelligence, to be able to link this information. And the fact that they didn't beggars belief. The fact that the son was on an ASIO watch list for the last several years, this is about multi-agency failure, not about law-abiding firearms owners who are doing the right thing. And there's no detail about any buyback or compensation if people are going to be forced to surrender their firearms. You know, I'm hearing from a lot of recreational shooters, target shooters, clay target shooters, hunters, a lot of people. Now we're seeing it's pivoted. The argument's pivoted. You know, they obviously see it as a vote winner for them. But I think they've underestimated, especially in the regions, they've underestimated the impact this will have.
So just to be clear, that one of the Bondi gunmen had six firearms registered to him, the father. You don't think that a limit on the number of firearms, say it were to have been in place?
No? No, it wouldn't have made any difference at all. Would not have made any difference at all. It's the shooter that is the problem, the person holding the gun, the person that puts it to their shoulder and squeezes the trigger. And more of us, we've got this radicalisation of people, and there's appropriate government agencies who are tasked to monitor, watch these people and identify them and ensure they don't get access to firearms. Restricting the number of firearms will do nothing to stop the crimes, and it will do nothing to stop the illegal firearm trade, which we know happens. It won't do anything to stop terrorists or gangsters or drug dealers. They're not going to hand their firearms in, and that's the real issue. The criminals won't do it. You're punishing law-abiding people.
If this gun reform goes through and, for example, it limits gun holders or license holders to less than five firearms, for example, who do you think will be most impacted by this?
Well, all firearms owners, because, farmers as well. Primary producers often have, different guns for different types of circumstances. So, like, for most primary producers, firearms are like a tool that they use on their farms each and every day, whether it's to put down stock or whether it's to control feral animals. They generally need more than a couple of guns to be able to do that effectively and humanely as well.
What about allowing, for example, primary producers to own more guns than, say, a recreational hunter?
Yeah. And I think, we don't know what's happening yet because we don't have the bill. I mean, I don't want to see quotas coming in and limitations coming in, but if they were to come in, primary producers should be given and afforded the opportunity to have more than, say, someone who's just a recreational hunting. But I don't really want to see it get to that.
Phil Donato, who's an independent member for the seat of Orange. You're listening to The Country Hour.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
We'll come back to the gun laws in a moment, but first to the new federal environment or nature laws. The Australian Conservation Foundation, they've long advocated for new legislation to stop deforestation, protect threatened species and establish a strong independent regulator such as the EPA to focus more as well on climate change and taking that into action and account in decision-making as well. Nathaniel Pell from the ACS says he hopes the new laws are robust enough to protect nature. He says the jury's still out, and also they need to provide advice and guidance to businesses about being sustainable.
Yeah, look, so Australia's federal environment law has been in place for about 25 years, and it hasn't been working very well at all. In that period, we've lost 8 or 9 million hectares of threatened species habitat. Well, we haven't lost it. It's been bulldozed and destroyed. And we've got the record for mammal extinctions. We've got more and more species being added to the threatened species list. So fixing those laws has been urgent for some time, and it's been delayed for some time, and it's overdue. And these are a step forward, these laws. There's a lot of unknowns yet. We still don't know what all of the standards look like that the laws will deliver outcomes based on. We know we're getting an independent environmental protection authority, and that's a good thing. But what kind of matters is how well resourced that is. We don't know that yet, and what it will be instructed to do. Fixing these laws has been urgent and important. One of the problems we had with the old regime, I guess, is that the laws were weak, but the enforcement and compliance was even weaker.
That could still happen now.
Supposed to be fixed. It could still happen now. We could have new laws with no one to enforce them, and that wouldn't be very effective at all for nature.
But we hear some businesses are worried about it. They think there might be too much red tape and regulation. Supermarkets are worried about it. Other food companies and agribusinesses are worried about the red tape.
I think if any business that's operating sustainably shouldn't be worried about these new laws, because good business practice, good management of nature-related risks and good reduction of impact, so forth, means that companies or businesses will be seeking to avoid damaging our most important parts of nature anyway. leading businesses, so businesses that were at the forefront of shifting their operations to more sustainable operations, and those businesses performed pretty well financially, you know, aren't too worried about it. It is companies that didn't want to change, the laggards, if you will, that are concerned. If they are concerned, then that probably means, to riff off Minister Watt's angle on this, if the laggards are worried, then the balance is probably close to right.
So you think if they're doing it right, they've actually got an accent on the environment and trying to improve things as a company or a big business, they should be okay. It's the ones that are doing the wrong thing that'll be targeted by, and already we're talking about green tape.
Yeah, that's right. Look, if you're a business and you're setting up a new project or new operations, you should already be trying to avoid doing harm to nature in the process. If you're doing that, then, you know, if you're doing it well and following a science-based process to begin with, or just following, you know, common sense if you're a smaller operation and can't afford to hire a scientist, you're probably not going to be having a significant impact on nature, or not one that can't be managed through an approvals process. You know, getting a project approved is just about saying, you can go ahead under these conditions, and, you know, if you don't, we'll stop you from going ahead. It's not about stopping development, it's about managing it. Most farmers, you know, we've talked about land clearing before, and ACF has done a lot of work investigating deforestation and land clearing around the country, and it's really a minority of farmers that are engaged in broad-scale clearing that would have anything like a significant impact on nature. Most farmers recognise that trees are important to their soil, to the local water cycle and rainfall patterns. They hold the riverbanks together, they contribute flood attenuation, and they help the climate. So most farmers aren't clearing the bush in vast ways, and certainly not mature, you know, remnant forest that would be home to threatened species. And if you're not doing that, you've got nothing to worry about. It doesn't stop routine management. It's not going to stop my father-in-law removing, you know, a tree that's died or that's got a branch loose. It's not going to stop that sort of stuff. It's really about avoiding the really damaging clearing that a minority are still engaged in.
Nathaniel Pell is from the Australian Conservation Foundation.
The Country Hour.
I found it pretty good, actually.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You never knock back rain.
The Country Hour.
You know, you should get around it.
Part of your community and your life for 80 years on ABC Radio.
Australia's wool clip is set to drop again next year. With new estimates, it could be down almost 13% on last year's production, which is the lowest in a century. The Australian Wool Production Forecasting Committee's estimate of shorn wool production for 25-26 is 244 million kilograms greasy. That's 12.6% lower than the 24-25 season estimate, and the number of sheep expected to be shorn is 56.5 million. That's down 10%. Stephen Hill is the chair of the National Wool Production Forecasting Committee with AWI.
Yeah, we've met for our third revision of the wool production for 2025-26. Compared to the August meeting, we've reduced it a further 7 million kilos, which is 12.6% lower than the previous season.
So a 12% drop lower than the previous season, also a drop in the number of sheep expected to be shorn?
Yeah, absolutely. They run hand in hand. There is one of the other factors. The big driver in the difference between August and December has more been the seasonal conditions. In southern New South Wales, Victoria, a bit of South Australia are having very tough seasons at the moment. So the cut per head and so forth is reduced, and the ability to run sheep on is more difficult. Whereas the major reason for the reduction in wool production, probably the two or three seasons before, have been economic reasons. But we've seen a dramatic increase in the market since July, August this year, and it's making wool and The Merino in its total capacity is a wool, meat and livestock, very viable and very competitive to other farm outputs and enterprises.
So that's kind of the good news in the industry at the moment, isn't it? Is that the price of meat and price of wool is actually not doing too badly at the moment, despite these forecasts of dropped production.
Absolutely. And that's what drives producers' decisions in what they will do going forward. And what I'm sort of trying to get at is if people can feed them and have enough water, the decisions to increase sheep numbers and increase the flock size, I think the sentiment is there and that will happen. And we've seen that from a few surveys that we've done of recent times. But in some of those key producing areas, it's very tough to do that yet. But when they can, and if the season improves, I think that they'll look at their other outputs and make the decisions that wool's the way to go.
There was predictions earlier at the start of the year that this was going to be the lowest wool clip in Australia's history. Have we reached that? Are we at the lowest clip ever?
Yeah, it's within 100 years, I think, we're at those lows. We were talking this season might be the lowest. We have revised that down slightly lower. So we're on the lows and lower than we'd hoped. And because of those other conditions I've just mentioned, potentially we can, get a baseline now and improve going forward.
How much has the flock shrunk this year in this season? So we have seen a lot of numbers drop, but exactly how much has it dropped by?
We're talking the flock around, well, for the sheep, Sean, we talk as far as wool production, we're talking 10.3% reduction year to date. Well, that's the forecast in any case, Annie.
What does recovery look like for the industry going into next year?
Well, it takes a little while to recover, actually, because we've had poor lambing numbers. There's the actual ewe flock has been reduced. So you'd see recovery, with all everything else being equal and the positive factors remaining strong as they are today. It takes a good 12 to 18 months to see significant recovery. I'd just like to see the numbers stabilise first, and then, but for any significant move, as I said, it takes 12 to 18 months to come through the system.
And will it be dependent on seasonal outlook and the weather?
Always seasonal is a huge factor, and those economic conditions. And if we can remain good pricing for wool and for sheep meat, I think we're very well placed for that to happen.
You also mentioned a bit earlier, we've also had drops in the last 2 to 3 seasons as well. So we sort of accumulated up. It's quite a big drop over the last 3 years, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's towards 30%. And that was originally driven by economic factors, it not being such a competitive output with low wool prices. But that's turned around now, and it's more the season that is having the most effect since the August meeting. And as I say, all things being equal and the outlook for wool is still very, very positive. Wool is in fashion. So if that maintains and the season improves, yes, we do see volumes to increase going forward.
You know, we've seen these good prices for lamb and high demand for mutton this year as well. So with prices going up, are you seeing more people sort of shift over from wool into sheep meat?
There is definitely been a trend from wool to prime lamb or sheep meat because of these high prices, and that's actually been a driving factor for people to destock or reduce numbers when if they're having difficulty feeding or watering their flock. Those very attractive prices out there are hard to miss. There's also record skin prices at the moment. But I still believe as a total package, the Merino still stacks up very well with the wool prices where they are and the outlook for wool prices going forward.
Stephen Hill is the chair of the National Wool Production Forecasting Committee with AWI, and he was speaking there to Annie Brown. It's coming up to 28 minutes to 1 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Time to find out what's happening with the weather. Jordan Notaro is at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
So pretty hot today.
Yeah, so definitely a warm overnight temperature for many areas west of the Divide. Ivanhoe only getting down to 29 degrees this morning, and temperatures, yeah, getting above 30 degrees very quickly, as you'd expect with these very clear skies in many areas. We did see a couple of storms still over the first few hours start to develop, and that's going to be a continual trend as we head through today, with the forecast being one of broadening storm activity through Friday. There's the chance we could see some potentially gusty storms in areas of the far west, so generally to areas near Griffith, Narrandera, and further towards back towards Broken Hill itself. And we could see, again, some gusts, as I say, around 90k an hour at the top end. From Saturday and Sunday, that storm risk is one that's going to continue west of the Divide, with the potential we could see some broadening areas, severe thunderstorms, particularly peaking as we head through Sunday itself. At the moment, not necessarily seeing widespread heavy rainfall. It is going to be a bit of a mixture of some broadening light rain and some embedded thunderstorm activity, but it is going to be peaking, particularly through that Sunday afternoon and evening, as we see an increase in moisture across the state, combining with those warm temperatures we've been seeing that have been lingering over the last few days.
And this system is already moving through the state now?
Yeah, so we have seen, obviously, just quite a stagnant high-pressure system increasing those warmer temperatures in those areas. What we're seeing as we head through Saturday and Sunday is the added feature of moisture from the tropical systems to the north. So that is going to be the mixture that we see as we head through into Sunday, peaking with those combination of those warm temperatures and moist conditions leading to the broadening areas, potential severe thunderstorms. But that storm risk itself is going to be one that we still see continuing across those more northern inland areas through Monday and into Tuesday as well, before Wednesday we start to see it shifting over the Divide to the northeast of New South Wales and broadening from there on even. We start to see a clearing trend from Christmas Day, with mostly some coastal showers east of the Divide, but western areas seeing some clearing skies.
Yeah, so when we're talking about rainfall, it's a bit hit and miss, sort of storm activity, some dry lightning, some storms, you know, we're not really expecting, lots of millimetres over a wide area, are we?
No. So particularly the only areas that we could be more confident would be around the higher topography around the southwest slopes. So that'd be the only areas just really sort of just south of Young down towards Tumut, where we're looking at potentially more around that sort of 10 to 20 millimetres of rain, particularly over the 24 hours of Sunday. Otherwise, areas in the west are going to be much more hit or miss, so we might get a couple of mils here or there, but most of it is going to be on the higher end, is going to be delivered by storm activity, and we're just going to have to wait and see exactly where that forms.
Right, so it's a bit, yeah, and it's difficult to predict because of the way it's sort of moving, but more likely to be in the Riverina and the southern part of the state still?
Yeah, so we definitely still have that good chance, but the moisture being fed in the way it is, that we get through Saturday and Sunday, a good amount of potential rainfall. We could see, again, around 5 or so millimetres falling broadly across the Riverina on Saturday and Sunday. The storm activity is, as I say, the wild card, so we could get some much higher totals in there as well. So there is a risk we could see severe thunderstorm warnings that are issued throughout the afternoon hours of both Saturday and Sunday in those areas. And at this stage, there's also a good chance we could see some hail as well in some parts, with the potential, obviously, with that amount of moisture and heat combined together, obviously the conditions are ripe to see severe thunderstorms.
But in the lead up to that, some pretty severe fire conditions.
Yeah, so the system obviously with warm temperatures at the moment, particularly today, as we mentioned, there is a bit of a dry lightning risk in those areas in the inland. At the moment, most focused area would be where, obviously, if we do still see areas around the Riverina that have got crops on the ground, we have got that potential for gusty thunderstorms, which are going to have that low rainfall rates expected. Through the Sunday period, that's what we're looking at this stage, the potential for areas around the central ranges themselves reaching those higher elevated fire dangers and potentially even into the Greater Hunter as well. From there on, with that change moving through, we do see a bit of a blip back down through those higher fire danger ratings, but still one to continue to monitor, particularly obviously if we do see new starts from these next few days of thunderstorm activity.
And into the new week, what can we expect then? Warming up again?
So the trend will be one of western areas still above average temperatures, eastern areas tending back towards more normal for this time of year. So some showers around parts of the coast around mid to late week, and then more of those northeastern areas, a pretty typical sort of time. So potentially afternoon storms from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But at this stage, still one to watch out for. We could obviously have conditions sufficient enough that we may even see some storm warnings issued around that period as well.
Right, so some tropical storm activity still around.
Yeah, so the moisture itself doesn't necessarily completely get flushed fully away. We do obviously see, as I mentioned, that peak happening during Sunday with the highest amount of moisture in the state. But we obviously still have sufficient conditions that we could see severe thunderstorms, being that we're in summer, obviously having moisture and warmer temperatures still around. It's obviously different, potentially we could see thunderstorm warnings being issued in the afternoons, particularly later next week.
Yes, from one extreme to the other. All right, Jordan, thanks for that.
Catch you later.
It's coming up to 20 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
G'day, Nick Grimm here. Join me for The World Today. The couple who confronted the Bondi gunman given a hero's farewell at their funeral in Sydney. From gun reform to deportations for hate preachers, the federal government's reaction to the shooting ramps up, but will it silence critics? And how sniffer dogs are helping to save the Murray River's freshwater turtles. Join me for those stories and more coming up soon on The World Today.
But here on The Country Hour, I wonder what you plan to put out on the Christmas table this year. A bowl of cherries, a nice ham, maybe some prawns too. What about turkey? At Tintinhull near Tamworth, the Quast family have been busy in their farm shop selling everything from turkey roasts to rissoles to turkey sausages. In fact, about 60,000 birds will make their way into homes across the New England Northwest, interstate, and even into Sydney as well. Lara Webster stopped in to see owner Cole Quast and find out more about his busy season.
Seasoned turkey rolls that we do in the fridge, all different sizes, 1.5 to 2 kilos. And then we've got plain turkey rolls over here in this one. About the same story. So plain turkey rolls got no strip of seasoning in the middle of them. And then whole birds. Every size whole bird from 3 kilos up to 10 kilos. Not necessarily.
Yeah, there are some big birds in there.
There are a couple of big birds in there.
And then you've got some of the specialties over here.
Yeah, we've run sausages and meats and turkey schnitzel, which is my favourite. Tastes nice. Rissoles, yeah. Chops, turkey breast.
And you've got a few customers leaving. I'd say it's been a busy morning.
Yeah, Tali's been quite busy here this morning. She's been busy looking after children, and she's sort of, yeah, she's filling in. The girl that normally does it today is not very well, so Tali's is filling in.
Right, let's go find our shady spot. This is a good spot. We can survey the operation. Cole, we're usually every year when I come here, we're sitting in that shop. We're out the back of the shop at Christmas. But this year, we've got a bit of a posse on the hill. We're looking out across your paddocks, the whole operation here, your turkey sheds. And I just want to start with the reflection on 75 years. This is your 75th Christmas in the turkey game.
Yeah, 75 years this year. My father started the business when he was 17. Yeah, things have changed in my time. Well, I'm 66 this year, so I suppose I've seen a lot of the change as things have changed, you know, after growing up here. But look around and see some old buildings that my father and uncle and dad's father sort of built when dad first came out here. It is. It's quite pleasing to sort of sit back and see what we've done and changed. Not necessarily always good, but yeah, I would like to think that we're continuing on with Dad's legacy.
Well, it's certainly a special legacy to be able to continue on with the next generation and your grandchildren who are hard at work, or at least I don't know if they're helping Mum down there, Cole, but they're in there. They're part of it.
Yes, they are. Colin Jock was actually spent the day with his dad and with me or Pa as they call me yesterday, and he worked all day. You know, he was helping set up sheds, he was spreading straw, he was putting swinging drinkers, and you know, sort of jobs that you'd only expect an adult to do. And he's only five. He hasn't even started school yet till next year, but he was quite happy, and he, you know, it's really good to see. And obviously, from what I saw yesterday, the work ethic might be there as well.
Every year I pop out here, we have a bit of a yarn about how things are looking for Christmas and demand this year. We just had a bit of a look around the shop. You've already got some more cars and customers walking in while we sit here. How has demand been this season?
Look, demand's been pretty good. Our freezer will be as good as empty, which is always nice for a turkey producer to empty his freezers out. You know, we did have a little bit of room to move, which is really good. Makes life a little bit easier, but yeah, the freezer's as good as empty. And look, at the end of the day, I pride myself on all the customers we got, being able to supply them with everything that they wanted. And when you've got a customer base of sort of, you know, high 40s to, you know, 50-odd customers that we supply, be it a small butcher or be it a large wholesaler that's buying, you know, B-double loads of turkeys, it's, you know, it's one of the things I pride myself on, that we can look after them.
How many turkeys did you produce and ended up in those freezers?
Yeah, probably somewhere between 55 to 60,000. I haven't added it all up yet, but yeah, somewhere near that. And most of those go out the door somewhere between October and this week, sort of the week leading up to Christmas. So yeah, it's pretty busy and gives me something to do late in the evenings or early in the night.
Well, how has this year gone in terms of your production? I mean, certainly talking to other farmers in different games, it's been a funny kind of a year. I mean, even, you know, we've had an even sort of a funny start to summer as well. But how has the year tracked for you and your production here?
Look, our production's been pretty good. You know, we didn't have any major issues with our production. We grow a little bit of our own grain, or we try to grow as much of our own grain as we possibly can, which was, you know, ours was down a little bit because the little block we got down at Kaluas is, we didn't get to sow it because of the rain, so we've had to buy a fair bit of grain in. But having said that, grain is relatively cheap at the moment, so that sort of sets next year up quite well. Our biggest issues are the input costs, you know, power costs, gas costs, and all those sorts of things, wages. You know, it's pretty hard at the moment in small business.
Well, Cole, if we look back at that shop front and that income that you've got to make, what's your most popular product down there?
Oh, look, in our shop here, it's definitely our turkey rolls that we've been making for the last 40 plus years. We were probably one of the first people in Australia, I believe, that sort of started cutting up turkeys and making, you know, turkey breast rolls and whatever. The roll that we make is a little bit old-fashioned now because it's got things like potato starch in it and dextrose that bind it all together. But, you know, the people keep on coming back and they keep on buying it. We sell quite a few into South Australia, which we've always done. But the demand in Tamworth for our turkey rolls is definitely still there. But, you know, across the board, breast meat, you know, sort of goes all over Australia. And, you know, the butchers are making their own turkey rolls out of it. And so, you know, there's a fair sale there. But there is still a good sale in the whole birds. People still like to carve up a whole bird at the table. And but some people find it too hard to cook compared to a simple turkey roll.
Can I ask, are there any turkeys left standing?
There is turkeys left standing. There's quite a few turkeys left standing out there because we're cranking up for next year. There's actually a hatch comes off Christmas Eve. It was due to come off Christmas Day, but I didn't think I'd be in the good books if I was working Christmas Day. So there'll be a hatch coming off Christmas Eve, but look, there'll probably be 10,000 turkeys walking around for next Christmas on the farm Christmas Day.
Yes, indeed. Turkeys for Christmas. Sounds like he's been pretty busy there. That's Cole Quast, who's a turkey farmer just outside of Tamworth, and he was speaking to our rural reporter, Lara Webster. Now, the Quasts are also marking 75 years in the turkey business. Well, staying with food for Christmas time, let's turn our attention to fish now. The Christmas period is always a busy one for Australia's seafood sector, as we know, and this morning in Darwin, there were a number of fishing boats offloading their catch just in time to get product into markets around the nation. Matt Brand went along to one of those boats to check out one of those boats that's delivering tropical snappers into the market for Christmas.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Christmas is just around the corner and I'm down at the Duck Pond in Darwin to watch some beautiful seafood getting unloaded this morning just in time for the Christmas period. I'm with Michael O'Brien from Australia Bay Seafoods. Tell us what's happening here this morning.
Well, Matt, we're as you mentioned, we plan our unloads to so we can meet the market for Christmas, so everyone can have fresh fish. This is the third boat to unload this week. We've been supplying the markets all over Australia and especially in Darwin. And this boat here, product will be what people buy off the over the counter in this weekend and leading up to Christmas.
Is this the last unload before Christmas?
Yeah, this is the last unload before Christmas. We have a double unload on Boxing Day. So like all good fishermen, we try to keep the supply regular to the people in Australia, and we work 52 weeks of the year. So even though it's Christmas and I don't get to watch the opening of the Boxing Day test, we'll be down here unloading fish for the fresh fish for the market to lead into the new year then.
So what's coming off the boat here today?
Well, we've got 85% of our catch is red snapper, which is made up of saddletail and crimson snapper, and then we have a little bit of gullband and a bit of sweet lip and a few other sprinklings through it, but the majority of it is crimson and saddletail.
And how far out has this boat travelled to get these?
Okay, this boat's just come back in. They all do 2 week trips. He's been working up on the border on the Australian side, up the top of the Wessels up near Wisteria. So we in Australia still, but out wide in the grounds just inside the Australian fishing zone.
Yeah. There was a cyclone that came through a week or so ago. Did that mean much to the fishers?
Oh yeah, we plan for it. So we monitor it with two or three different sites. I spend hours tracking it. We had one boat got caught in Darwin. Took us 3 days to get him back out due to rules and regulations. But the other boats, we just moved them further to the east, away from it. And then once it had gone south and started to head southwest, we just moved the boats back in. So we didn't lose a lot of time at all, except for the boat that got caught in Darwin, that was all.
Does a system like that stir up the fishing grounds and change the behaviour for a short period?
Not so much on fish, but on prawns, it does. It normally something like that will slow the prawning down for at least a week until the pressures all come back up. But with the fish, no, I haven't noticed it that much. But earthquakes, we find, upset the fish and make them leave the bottom and go into the midwater.
Oh, right. So every time in Darwin you feel a bit of a shake because of something happening usually out in the band of sea, you notice that as a fisher of tropical snappers?
Yeah, we do. We notice that the fish drops off. Also, the fish drops off when the tides are really big too. So it can be a mixture of things, but really noticeable if there's a big quake. You notice that normally it's 3 or 4 days before it. And as if everyone knows underwater that it's coming, and us on top just aren't aware of it.
We just wait.
Yeah.
And so as we get towards the back end of 2025, what sort of year has it been for the business?
Yeah, it's been a good year for us. We brought our new boat in that I've just spent 2 years making in Vietnam and Haiphong, and It's been here working now for just under 5 months and doing really well. We're very proud of the new boat and how it's working. It's always a tough year. Markets are tough. Environmental groups are tough. Everyone's tough on fishermen. So we're really starting to feel like an endangered species. But we love what we do, and we try and we work hard at a sustainable fishery. So we'll just keep moving ahead, and hopefully 26 will be a better year.
Oh, well, the snappers here today look great. Thanks so much for your time, Mike.
No worries at all, Matt. Thanks, eh?
Michael O'Brien is a manager for Australia Bay Seafoods. Well, let's turn our attention now to cane toads. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development has confirmed that a cane toad has been spotted on a busy intersection of the Great Western Highway at Lithgow. A resident who found the toad described it as the largest frog he'd ever seen, and it was about the size of his hand. DPIRD specialist, technical specialist Nathan Cutter says while there is an endemic cane toad population in northeast New South Wales, cane toads are also notorious stowaways. He spoke about the toad to reporter Emily Middleton and about what it means for the community and what residents should be doing.
Cane toads are notorious stowaways. They're amazing adaptive species that do stow away on vehicles like trucks, perhaps a truck carrying materials like pot plants or gardening supplies or landscape supplies may have been travelling through the Lithgow area and the toad, adult toad, jumped off. The area that the toad was detected is a very busy sort of intersection of the Great Western Highway and the main street of Lithgow, so there's a potential that the toad could have just jumped off as a stowaway.
Can cane toads survive in a cool climate area like Lithgow?
Look, they're incredibly tough amphibians, so they can survive a huge range of temperatures from 5 degrees Celsius right up to scorching temperatures of over 40 degrees, so they can adapt and survive. However, Lithgow is pushing it a little bit with temperatures over winter getting below zero. That's not really a preferable temperature range for cane toads. They're a tropical toad, and it's unlikely that toads would be able to establish and breed and establish an ongoing population in the Lithgow area. However, over time, we have had localised satellite populations of cane toads established in other areas of the state, including in the Sutherland Shire. Cane toads were detected in 2010, and we had to do a lot of work over many years to remove cane toads from that area, that southern sort of distribution area on the south coast of New South Wales. And indeed, they've been detected in places like South Australia and Victoria as well. But just those areas are just not so ideal for cane toad populations breeding up. Also, it's a long way from those endemic areas of Australia where cane toads have established.
You said that the cane toad wasn't captured, but what will happen now?
What we've been able to implement is a community awareness program. So we've had the Central Tablelands Local Land Services staff, their biosecurity officers from Central Tablelands, go out to the community, do an inspection of that particular area, and also inform the community through a letterbox drop around the detection area so that residents are aware and alert to the presence of a cane toad.
What is the likelihood of this one cane toad found in Lithgow spreading and it becoming a bigger problem?
I'm never going to say that it's an impossibility, because cane toads can overwinter, and obviously it's a warmer part of the year right now. We don't know at this stage, Emily, if it's a single cane toad or whether it potentially arrived, like I said, in pots or landscaping supplies with other toads potentially. So there is a need for us to work with the community and staff of the biosecurity unit to follow up on each of these reports to make sure that the biosecurity risks are managed appropriately.
How concerned should we be?
Cane toads do, they're able to poison pets, for example, and humans. They excrete a toxic substance from their parotid glands, and that can cause illness and potentially death, quite rapid death, in say a dog mouths a cane toad or licks a cane toad. That's a real concern to the community. So we do want to follow up, and we do want to capture this cane toad and remove it.
Nathan Cutter from the DPIRD, a vertebrate pest technical specialist there, and the advice is if you see or suspect a detected cane toad in Lithgow or any other area of New South Wales, report it to the local authorities. Now, some other sugar news. Many of us are starting to wind down ahead of Christmas and New Year. No such luck for the cane farmers on the Clarence. There'll still be cane fields to burn and crops to harvest until at least mid-January due to the weather and sugar mill issues this season. Outgoing Sunshine Sugar CEO Chris Connors says they'll be working through the Christmas break to ensure that Harwood Mills gets the crop crushed. And he says it's never ideal to crush through to January, and that the mill needs millions of dollars of maintenance work done. So that's the reason for the delay.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
So that's the program for the day and the week. And you're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour.